Welcome to CSCE's This Compassionate Life with Linda Caldwell. Linda is a chef, writer, and food and farms advocate in Portland, Oregon. She is a driving force behind the efforts of Portland Public Schools, the City of Portland, and local partners, including farms, to bring fresh local food into school cafeterias while teaching kids about its benefits. Through her work, she exposes people to lessons in botany, environmental appreciation, food education, and character development in a school garden.
So I was thinking I would tell you this little story that happened to me at some point this spring. I had started to talk to some filmmakers because I met them in the context of a field trip around school garden education. A couple of very talented women who have produced some very powerful films, and they're really interested in the urban agriculture and the movement in Portland, and I'm really interested in sort of pursuing that with it as a film. And they came over to my house one day, and I had to do all kinds of arranging to make sure the dog wasn't there and the family was gone, so that, you know, things were kind of quiet. And of course, you know, a few minutes into the interview, my teenage son comes home unexpectedly and the door slams, and, you know, there's all this activity, and they're very sensitive because they're recording with very high powered microphones. And finally the whole house settles down. We've unplugged the refrigerator because it was humming in the background, and we proceed on with the interview. And at one point, the woman interviewing me stops and she says, "I'm sorry, but there's a really, really strange noise coming from the kitchen." And I said, "I can't think of what it could possibly be, because, you know, the animals are gone and the refrigerator, we already unplugged it, and these things." And she said, "I'm still hearing it, and it's coming up on the recording and everything." And I said, "It's the chickpeas." She said, "What?" I said, "It's the chickpeas. The German word translation for chickpea is giggling. And when you soak them on the counter overnight, they start to pop and make these funny noises. And it's because, you know, they're alive. They're going through their process." And she said, "Well, you've got to put them away. You've got to get rid of them because they're a distraction." And I was like, wow, what a fascinating thing, because these chickpeas are really what we're talking about. And so in the context of my kitchen, they were a problem because they were making noise while they were doing their thing. And that's one of the things that just fascinates me when I work with kids and with academic institutions or with professionals. We've forgotten that we're talking about food, and all of a sudden we're telling ourselves that we really need to remove the food so that we can focus and not hear it, because it's, you know, it's like a cat at the door saying, "Hey, I'm here. So it was just a very fascinating moment for me, you know, to have this sort of thing that we're talking about being asked very politely to leave the room. I'm really interested in this larger notion of how did we ever become so disconnected from our food system? Children should know where their food comes from. It's sort of this big octopus of a statement. I don't know how to ground myself in that statement. What are we really talking about here? Like, what is the real meaning of what our connection to food is? And in 2008, I led a pilgrimage for the Unitarian Church to Transylvania, to the very small villages in Transylvania, which are Hungarian-speaking villages that are in the country of Romania. And there's a really fascinating and very poignant, painful history between the Hungarians and the Romanians. And the Unitarian Church was founded there over 500 years ago. And I led a pilgrimage to Transylvania called the Theology of the Table. We knew some of the things that we were going to do, which was really to be in a very, very rural environment, 200 to 400 person villages, and really looking at how they are connected to their land seasonally and the role that food plays in community and in their spiritual lives. And it was a really interesting experience for me, because to sort of go and witness this and experience it, sort of observing and being academic about it, it was hard for me to say, oh, this is where those two things intersect, right here, right now. And yet, as I have reflected on that over the years, it's very clear where that happens, because their food systems, by and large, are so short and so concrete, and they still transcend these very, very large communities of participation. So on this one morning, Friday morning, we went to see the village baker and his wife. Very traditional, very old wood-burning oven and a very old type of dough. So Friday morning, we gathered with the village baker, and he still bakes about 15 loaves of bread a week for really the older people in the village who really appreciate this old traditional bread. The really remarkable thing about this bread baking is that it's unlike any that I've done here. The oven is heated very, very hot, and then the loaves of bread are put in it, and the door is shut, and you leave for 2 hours. It comes out with a really, really black crust. It looks like a black bowling ball. And then the next process is his wife would take a old carbon knife and chip the carbon of the burntness off the whole exterior of the loaf of bread. And then the baker would take a box grater type thing, and he would grate it, or with a hand plane, and he would grate all of the darkness off, meanwhile catching all of these crumbs, because the crumbs were valuable and useful for a whole other dish. They're plum dumplings. And in the end, the bread is this beautiful golden color, like the color of fur. And the crust is very thick, and the bread is very dense, because the oven cooks it so fast, and at such a high temperature, it doesn't get a chance to get airy and fluffy. And consequently, I really believe because of that structure, it lasts a long time because it's really dense. And I think I ate from this one loaf for over a week and it was still fairly moist. So we made this bread on Friday morning, and Saturday morning of that year was the traditional Thanksgiving, which happens in September. And it's one of the four times of year that the Transylvanian Unitarian Church has communion. And so this was the bread. We were actually making the bread for communion at the church. You know, it was very wonderful for me to have my hands in the dough and to be a participant in this. And then Saturday morning rolls around, and there's a lot going on getting ready for the church service. And actually, the church service was on Sunday morning because the pig kill was on Saturday morning. It's just a tremendous amount of activity. I was staying at the minister's house with his family, and the Bishop of Transylvania of the Unitarian Church was on his way to do the service, and it was a very important event. And as a chef, I sort of stepped into the kitchen and I said, "Well, I'll cut the bread for communion." And I found out very quickly that that's the minister's job. You cannot touch this sacrament unless you are a minister. So my friend who I was doing the trip with, she's the minister, and she's a friend and colleague. And so she and another woman, who American Unitarian minister, they cut all the bread for the service. And that, to me, was just an incredibly powerful moment when this loaf of bread that we made on I guess it was a Thursday morning, and it was a community event. And then it walks from, you know, in my arms from one village back to the other village for the service the next morning. And the minute that day of communion happens, that bread becomes holy and can only be touched by the ministers. So something happened to that bread in that transformation, in that period of time when it was being prepared. And my hands as a chef were no longer useful. And I found that just like an extraordinary moment. So the wine that they use for communion also comes from the village. Everybody brings something that they have made, and it's sort of all combined. So the food and the wine comes from the people and is transformed and given to the people. And I thought that was such a perfect example of the antithesis of what we experience in our more modern or urban food systems, is we have no way of knowing or even saying thank you to the pig that's killed that we eat for dinner, unless we're actually hunting or fishing or, you know, perhaps. I think I know a lot of people who grow their own vegetables, or people who farm. They have a really strong sense of, you know, that cycle of life in a botanical sense. That was when I started to realize we've sort of lost that firsthand knowledge and firsthand experience. Anytime I have killed an animal or a fish, it's that same extremely sort of powerful, very tangible moment of I have an obligation to do right by this animal. It's the only thing I can do because I'm so aware of the life it's given for my life.
You mentioned leading a trip which you termed Theology of the Table, and I just wondered what that looks like in your household. Would you say that for your family there's a spiritual dimension to eating?
That's a great question. It's a really, really hard one to answer. For me personally, there is a profoundly spiritual dimension to it. There have been a few meals that I've served in my house, and there have been a few meals that I have prepared for my very large extended family, where, with the exception of wine, I can tell you where every single ingredient came from. And I would never tell you that as we sat down to the table, because there is a weight that you would have to carry, if I told you, a responsibility that you would have to carry, and you're first guest in my house. And there is a privilege to it, to being able to say that, you know, the fish came from here and the quail came from here and the corn came from here. That is my spiritual act. And if you walked in my kitchen, you would find cabinets are built by my husband by hand, and one of them came from somewhere in Maine that I brought across the country. The dishes that we have been in my husband's family for three generations, and they have soul. And I create the world in this way because that's what speaks to me. There's a lot of meaning in the plate I choose to put the food on. But I also realistically have two children, and they are teenagers, and they are in the process of becoming, and I can create an environment, but I cannot dictate that environment. And so they will benefit from it, and they have in many ways. When they move out into the world and they come home and they bump up against the world versus the world that they grew up in. I would say that if you were to walk in perhaps with a checklist, or if there was some evaluation, you know, that could be performed on these things, so when we go, yep, you definitely got a nice hard core of spirituality in your daily rituals in your food. But I haven't done that because I've been afraid to create a world of words around that. Instead, you know, the food that I get in the house is most often a gift, or I buy it because I am making a market exchange, but it's because I've made a choice about supporting that producer. You know, but at the same time, if my kids want to eat Nutella, they're going to eat Nutella, and that's part of their growth. For me, it's also this separation and this individuation that has to happen in the house, because I can't be a tyrant about it. So my husband is a fabulous cook, and he loves to get excited and default to some of the foods of his growing up. It would be spiritually wrong for me to say I can't accept your tuna noodle casserole. So it's a really interesting question. When I am cooking, and when I am cooking for certain, you know, people or for certain events, a tremendous amount of thought and criteria ends up shaping it, and you could look at it and pick it apart very carefully. You know, from the salt that was a gift from a woman I gave a tour to who came from Hawaii to see a number of projects that I'm involved in, right? That salt has meaning because it has a storyline to it now.
You mentioned earlier your activist work in the context of being a chef, and I wonder if you could address to what degree we're all food activists whenever we eat.
It's hard even for me to know what activist means anymore, because everything that I do because I think of it as knowledge and sharing of knowledge. I'm still trying to mature into, you know, what it means to be a more active participant in something. Are we activists because we choose to shop at a farmer's market or to grow our own food? And is that a form of activism? Or is our activism actually much more in the way we vote or the stand that we take on land use policy, you know, and questions around that? And a number of years ago, this national event, but it was pretty big in Portland too, about, you know, foie gras. You know what foie gras is. You know, there was a lot of demonstrations and activists saying, you know, restaurants, this is, you know, inhumane, and restaurants shouldn't be serving this. I have a tremendous amount of respect and regard for that form of activism. And yet it was very, very sad to me because no one ever talked about large-scale pig factory farms, which to me are a much bigger issue and problem than the production of foie gras. I am very interested in this process of giving life and taking death in the food system. I'm going to do a very brief study around foie gras production in France, and very, very small scale production in a way that has been done for years and years and years. And generally, the biggest moral issues around food production happen as soon as we get into larger scale, because the management systems are completely different and the price structures or the economics of the bottom line become completely different. The labor force has to be different. This opportunity to spend time in a very, very small scale production of foie gras is a way to see how culturally and historically something has evolved. I'm interested in how that compares to larger scale productions of animal husbandry. I don't even think you can call it animal husbandry after it gets to be a certain number of animals. We don't even have language or a word yet for these really large systems that have huge environmental devastation. And that's, to me, a really fascinating component. You know, we're very quick to say this is cruel, but we're not at all quick to say, well, this is cruel to the environment. When we look at this different forms of animal, our meat production systems, for me, coupled with that is that generations have taken care of, you know, a raised foie gras or small-scale animal production and have used it as a form of income. And whether you're in the United States or you're in the EU, a lot of those traditions have been removed, or the privilege of having that ability to do that and have autonomy has been taken away because of issues around food safety and rules and regulations. Now, Oregon just recently has gone through two pretty significant changes in legislation that gives the right to field process to a certain level for small farmers and growers here. And also, I think there's now a bill that allows chicken processing up to 1,000 chickens with certain parameters and infrastructures. There is this whole food safety thing, and yet at the same time, the people who know how to keep food safe are the people who have been doing it for a really long time, and they have the knowledge. A friend of mine says that it's really farmers that understand acidity levels more than anybody, because plants have to respond to that, and they have to, in order to have good production, they have to understand these things. So it makes sense for the people who are producing food to be involved in their processing, as opposed to larger scales that aren't. So, you know, when you say food activists, it's sort of like, to me, there's an enormous basket full of lots of different forms of food activism, from the people who are very proactive and demonstrate outside of restaurants that are serving foie gras, and then there are people who try and tell a regional and rational different form of the story, or really even look at it in the form of policy. I think I am a food activist, but I know I'm not the one that's going to be, you know, collecting signatures or trying to shut down a restaurant or preventing those things, because, again, that falls back into the realm of we have rights to do things. It's scary for me to see these, you know, rights removed, whether it's because it's cruel or not safe. I think we're very quick to do the right thing sometimes, you know, and it may not be the right thing.